Welcome to ADA Today, a podcast of the Mid-Atlantic ADA Center. My name is Caleb Berkemeyer, training specialist for the center, and I'm joined today by Nancy Horton, our information specialist. Hello, Nancy.
Good morning.
So today we're talking about a hot button topic that's generated a lot of questions, confusion, and contention as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to raise new challenges for our society. Many states or local governments have issued orders for people to wear face masks or face coverings when they're in public, and many agencies or businesses have established similar policies of their own. Now, as many of you know, state and local governments are covered by Title II of the ADA, and many types of private businesses that are open to the public are covered by Title III. Now, entities covered under these parts of the ADA must make reasonable modifications to their policies, practices, and procedures in order to accommodate people with disabilities. And some people with disabilities have difficulty wearing face coverings. So, for example, people with conditions that affect breathing may have problems with face masks, or people with other types of disabilities, including autism, intellectual disabilities, or mental health issues, may have trouble managing face coverings. So, Nancy, with this context in mind, people may be wondering, am I exempt from mask requirements because I have a disability?
Well, not necessarily. As you mentioned, state and local government agencies and many private businesses must make reasonable modifications to their policies, practices, and procedures in order to accommodate people with disabilities, but that does not mean that every request of a person with a disability must be granted.
So a person with a disability does not automatically get the modification that he or she requests or prefers?
No, a covered entity may consider legitimate factors, such as the cost or difficulty of making adjustments, valid safety rules, or the risk of direct threat to the health of others.
What's the difference between a direct threat and a safety rule?
In terms of Title II and Title III of the ADA, a direct threat means a particular individual with a disability poses a significant risk to the health or safety of others that cannot be reasonably eliminated. Determining direct threat is based on an individualized assessment of a specific person within a specific situation. Safety rules, on the other hand, are merely general rules that are based on general concerns, and they're legitimate if they are really necessary for safe operations and not based on speculation, assumptions, stereotypes, or generalizations. An example of a safety rule is no glass containers in a swimming pool. That's a simple rule most of us are familiar with, and most of us understand that it's based on real risks for the potential of broken glass winding up in or around the swimming pool where it's wet and slippery and everyone is barefoot. So the real difference between direct threat and a safety rule is that defending a safety rule is really about the rule and making sure the rule is legitimate. But determining direct threat is really about a person and looking at that person in the context of a situation and finding that that individual person really poses a significant risk to the health or safety of other people, and that just cannot be accommodated.
We've seen a lot in the news about social media postings, so-called ADA cards, and other materials that people are presenting to businesses saying that because of the ADA, they are exempt from face mask requirements and that they can't be questioned about that. The Department of Justice has issued a couple of press releases calling these materials fraudulent, but does this mean that people with disabilities never have the right to request a modification of these face mask requirements?
No, not necessarily. I think the problem with some of these cards and other materials is that they address the issue as if it's a one-size-fits-all kind of situation. The application of the ADA doesn't usually work that way. It often requires consideration of various factors in different situations to balance access and the rights of people with disabilities with things like legitimate safety rules, costs or difficulties in making adjustments, and so forth. People with disabilities can certainly request modifications, and agencies and businesses can consider the various factors that may come into play in the context of their programs and their businesses. Covered entities, that is, agencies and businesses, can and should make decisions in a case-by-case way. Sometimes a person might be able to enter a facility without a mask. Other times, an alternative might be provided, such as the popular curbside pickup option. But there may also be some services that can only be provided in a close, face-to-face sort of way, like getting a haircut, for example. And providing that service without face coverings or similar precautions may not be possible. One statement from the Department of Justice that they make in one of their press releases on this subject is, quote, "The ADA does not provide a blanket exemption to people with disabilities from complying with legitimate safety requirements necessary for safe operations," unquote. And I think that really speaks to the problem of this blanket sort of approach instead of an approach that takes individual factors into consideration.
Right. Now, if a person says that they cannot wear a face mask, can business operators ask for medical documentation?
This is something that's really not clear at this point in time under Titles 2 and 3 of the ADA. The Department of Justice's regulations generally prohibit covered entities from even asking about disability unless it's really necessary. But there are times it is necessary and therefore allowed. There are a few specific situations where the regulations speak to the question of getting medical documentation. And there's some variety in when, where, why, and how much can be asked for. Many of these situations are discussed in the context of making reasonable policy modifications. On one end of the spectrum, for example, we've got situations like people using service animals. A person bringing a clean, well-behaved dog into a restaurant, for example, can be asked if the dog is a service animal needed because of a disability and what task or work the dog has been trained to do for the person, but nothing further. The restaurant operator can't ask what the person's specific disability is or anything else. On the other end of the spectrum, if a person tells a college that she has a learning disability and asks for extra time on tests, the college can require medical documentation to verify that the person has a learning disability that would necessitate extra time on tests. Then the college would determine if granting extra time would be appropriate in the context of specific tests and what they're designed to measure. Requiring documentation is allowed in a situation like that because otherwise an accommodation might be granted that would give the test taker an unfair advantage or render the test results meaningless. The situation we have now with COVID-19 and face covering requirements is really new and it's unique. It certainly seems clear that there are real risks of spreading this highly contagious and potentially deadly disease if we don't take some pretty strict precautions. But in many situations, I think it will not be necessary to get medical documentation in order for covered entities to determine whether an individual can be accommodated without a face covering.
Now, when might it be legitimate to ask for medical documentation?
Well, that's a really good question, and we've been racking our brains trying to come up with scenarios where it might make sense for a covered entity to ask for medical documentation. I think maybe in some of those situations where the relationship between the covered entity and the individual is a close or ongoing one, and accommodating an individual would require really extensive or challenging measures, there may be times when getting documentation would not be inappropriate. And many of those situations would be the types of situations where covered entities might generally be allowed to get documentation, such as the example we mentioned about providing testing or academic accommodations in college. College is a situation where an individual is in classes or dormitories or other shared spaces for extended periods of time on a regular basis. Accommodating an individual who cannot wear a face covering might require some pretty extensive measures. Perhaps the individual would need to be placed in a dormitory room by herself when students are typically required to share a room with a roommate. And when a student normally requests that sort of modification, the college would be allowed to get documentation of the disability and the need if those things are not obvious.
Should people have to prove what their specific disability is, or can it be generic proof of disability?
I think that in the rare instances where it might make sense to require proof at all, it would need to be specific to the particular disability and the disability-related need. Otherwise, some people might not get the modifications they really need, and others might be granted unnecessary modifications, which could reduce or interfere with the ability of the covered entity to provide adjustments for those who really need them. For example, if a store operator provides free home delivery or curbside pickup, which they normally charge a fee for, as an alternative to requiring a face covering for those with disabilities who cannot wear a face covering, then the operator of the store might argue that they should be able to verify the need for that. Otherwise, they may wind up engaging more of their workers in unnecessarily providing for free a service they normally charge for.
So, what if so many people refuse to wear a mask that it becomes an unacceptable disruption to operations?
Well, first of all, people cannot simply refuse to abide by a legitimate safety rule. If people do not believe that a mask requirement is a legitimate safety rule, but rather a rule that is unnecessarily screening them out, excluding them based on their disabilities, they can challenge that rule under the ADA by filing a complaint or a lawsuit. But if such a rule is considered to be or found to be legitimate, then people cannot simply refuse to comply with it any more than they can refuse to abide by the no glass in the swimming pool rule. But what they can do is request a modification that allows them to access goods or services. In some instances, simply being allowed to enter a facility without wearing a mask might be reasonable. For example, a person might be able to enter a store at a time it's not very busy or crowded and get what they need while easily maintaining very generous social distancing. But at another time or in a different store, it might be a different situation. And that brings us back to your original question. Is there a tipping point where allowing so many people to enter without face coverings that it becomes unreasonable simply by virtue of the numbers? And I think that could be a consideration. Many places are limiting occupancy already, limiting the number of people they allow into a store or a gym or an office based on calculations of mask wearing and social distancing. And if everyone or almost everyone is wearing a mask, perhaps more people can be accommodated in the space. But if only a few people are wearing masks, really effective social distancing may become too challenging. And at some point, it may affect operations so adversely that it can't be sustained.
So what are some examples of modifications other than not requiring a mask?
I'm glad you asked that, because I think in many cases there will be alternatives that can balance the needs of people with disabilities who really cannot wear face coverings with the rights of agencies and businesses of society, really, to implement measures to limit the spread of this dangerous disease. Businesses and agencies are coming up with lots of creative ways to provide goods and services while limiting close contact. I applaud businesses and agencies for their efforts and urge them to continue to do those things, to try to find reasonable ways to accommodate people when possible. We mentioned curbside pickup and home delivery earlier, and those are common examples. Other examples include adjusting appointment times to reduce exposure in waiting rooms and conducting appointments by telephone or online. I think if agencies, businesses, and those they serve talk to each other, they will find solutions, at least in many cases. Communication and creativity are key. I would also urge businesses and agencies to carefully consider their policies and post signs and make information available on their websites and so forth to communicate those policies, including any options they may have available, such as ordering online or by phone, and provide contact information so people who want to talk to someone about policies and options will have an avenue to do that. Also, I would recommend that businesses and agencies train their employees in how to approach people who are not following policies and how to communicate about those policies and options.
ADA Today is produced by the Mid-Atlantic ADA Center. For questions about the Americans with Disabilities Act, call the ADA National Network toll-free at 1-800-949-4232 and visit our website at adainfo.org. The Mid-Atlantic ADA Center is a grant-funded project operated by Transcend Incorporated, whose mission is to improve the lives of people with disabilities through meaningful work and community inclusion. Find out more by visiting transcend.org.